Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Joanna Nesseth, and I head up our work on food security at CSIS, and I'm a Senior Vice President for Strategic Planning. We're glad to have you here to talk about an issue that we don't really talk about all that much when we discuss food security. Since CSIS has been talking about food security over the past 5 years and Feed the Future has been stood up, we have a lot of conversation about grain production and some about livestock production, but we don't talk about fish all that often and this enormously important source of protein for so much of the world. So today we really want to highlight the increase in demand that's coming for fish protein and over the next several decades and talk about some of the both the tools that exist in the U.S. government to tackle this, some of the challenges around really sustainable fishing and fisheries, and kind of draw a baseline for what demand is going to look like, what some of the issues are, and we hope by the end of the discussion today to come out with a few ideas for areas that we can pursue in U.S. policy that will meet the interests of our partner countries and exploit some of the good things that we do in government that we maybe don't talk about as much around scientific exchanges, exchange of data, other things like that. So I will mention that we have some deep expertise in our panel. I'm going to let Ted Osius introduce everyone who's in this panel today. But Ted is with us from the U.S. Department of State. He's a visiting fellow. And he is very knowledgeable about Asia and especially Southeast Asia. He most recently served as the Deputy Chief of Mission at the Embassy in Indonesia and has kind of helped us put together our thinking today. And I'm going to mention one of the areas where U.S. Research efforts have been trying to focus on fish and fisheries is in it, something called a CRISP, a Collaborative Research Support Program, which is a big collaboration of researchers in U.S. universities and international universities looking at some of the problems and challenges around a particular issue. In this case, we have an aquafish collaborative research support program that's operating they have projects in about 16 countries. So I don't know if we'll talk a little bit about that, but that is one thing that's underway. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to you all, make introductions, and get us started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks to everybody for coming. Before I introduce our panelists, and I will do so as each speaks, I just wanted to say a very quick thank you to two people who aren't here. One is Dave McKinney from NOAA, who first took me out and introduced me to the dangers that are faced by deep water fish, pelagic fisheries, ocean fisheries. And the second is Alfred Nakatsuma from USAID, who showed me the dangers that exist in Indonesia to the coastal fisheries. Because of those two individuals, I became convinced that, as Johanna said, an understanding of food security focused only on grain isn't relevant to the people of Indonesia or to the people of Southeast Asia. And so I felt it was very important that we do a deeper dive on this issue. I'm very glad that Johanna invited us to do this today. So let me start by introducing Dr. Roger Pulwardy, the Climate and Societal Interactions Division Chief at NOAA. Roger's research and his publications focus on climate and weather impacts assessment, risk management, and climate and weather services in the United States, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Roger's a lead author on national and international climate assessments, and an expert on climate and weather impacts assessment and management, as we'll see from his presentation. Roger, thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me here. It's good to have the mic on. You'll understand even less of what I'm about to say. So, based on my communication technique, I'm Roger Pulwardy. I'm going to speak a bit to the issue of fisheries and food security. We do quite a bit of work in the food security arena. But one of the things I think is critical, as Ted just pointed out, is to get this understanding of what is at risk when we talk about fish, about resources, and then even more intimately, what is at risk to people's lives and livelihoods in this context. Next. Okay, so just to give you a sense of stuff is changing, the only constant is change, as they like to say, or as has been said before, you don't need to be the Dalai Lama to know that life is about change. Humidity, glaciers, snow cover, sea level rise, And that feature down at the bottom where we look at ocean heat content, that's in the data. This is not modeled information. This is not created in any other fashion than by taking a large set of data and doing the quality control on it. If anybody has things that moves in a different direction, please show me your data. No, thank you. So there's the temperature over land, and these are up to the present. These are the trends that we're seeing around the world. There's the ocean heat content, as I pointed out. Next slide, temperature over the oceans. I wanted to show this. This is probably the noisiest, Barbara, myself, and others in the room are probably scientists. We form a geekosystem. This is the only technical slide I'm going to show. There's the increasing heat around the world within the oceans. Again, this is in the data. And you can see the trends over the Atlantic Ocean, the South Atlantic, but certainly in the South Pacific, the North Pacific, and the Pacific Ocean itself, showing an increase in the heat being contained in the oceans. And why does that matter? Everybody talks about the heat being contained in the atmosphere. In fact, the oceans, of course, drive our climate. And it drives the circulation around the world that allows for nutrients, that allows for coastal communities to actually gain access and utility for its food. So we know things are changing. Next slide. What else is changing? The chemistry of the ocean is changing. Very definitely, if you look at this little chart with the precipitous fall, that's not the fiscal cliff over on the left there. All that shows is the pH is becoming more acidic. The oceans are becoming more slightly acidic around the world. It doesn't take much in the oceans actually to break down coral. It breaks down the aragonite. And so what we're seeing around the world in different places are the weakening of the construct, the things that make up coral reefs. So on the one hand, I pointed to the ocean thermal content that really helps direct where fish migrate, where they go to, how deep they go, and then the chemistry within the water. And so we'll come back to some of this. Next slide. What else are we seeing? 84% of the world's fish stocks are fully exploited, overexploited, or depleted. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, if we're not careful, we'll end up where we're going. As somebody who deals in predictions, that's about as good a prediction as I can make. I think there are no new Chinese proverbs because we didn't listen to the old ones. According to the UNFAO, so all that tells us is that those top set of fish there, that's the depth to which we catch most of our stuff. There's the stuff down at the bottom. And if you look to the bottom right, there you can see global oil production and marine fisheries landings. The only reason I show that slide is to show the parallel, not necessarily causative, between the industrialization efforts that we have and our capabilities to catch more fish. Next slide. What else are we doing? We're fishing down the food web. We're catching smaller and smaller size fish around the world because we've caught a lot of the big ones, regardless of stories to the contrary. Next slide. So what does this mean? The definition of food security from the Food and Agricultural Organization is when all people at all times have physical and economic access to safe, sufficient, nutritious food. The three dimensions of food security are utilization, access, availability. In Indonesia, in the handouts you have summarized, you'll see the high utility for rice, and it is in fact in the region in Southeast Asia that pays the highest price for rice, soybeans. And the error that we usually make when we look at GDP as indicators, fish production is only 5%. Yet 60% of the consumption is in fish. And this is really the sort of sleight of hand I think that Ted was getting at. When we begin to think in terms of agricultural and commodities production, when in fact the direct nutrients that we get and protein are more in this area related to fish. Aquaculture production has increased, and we'll hear a lot more about the trade-offs between aquaculture and wild fisheries. Next slide. So, climate impacts. The potential impacts on physical features of the ocean we've seen surface temperatures, sea level rise, ocean circulation patterns, salinity, amount of salt in the water, potential impacts on marine fish, migration patterns. Now, a lot of people, one of the centers that I work with is the National Drought Information Center, and people say, well, what's drought got to do with fish? Most contentious issue we have in the United States right now in any watershed is the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint Basin in the southeastern U.S. Why is that critical? Because low flows as a result of drought and extraction is now increasing the damage to shellfish, the shellfish industry in the basin. Low flows produce high salinity, high temperatures, and that's the conditions for producing higher disease in those shellfish. So there is a link to some of these. The potential impacts on marine fish are migration patterns, changes in reproductive patterns, and the food web effect next. So there's a big sort of colorful slides, as I was explaining in the little gathering we had before this. When your correlations are low as a scientist, you have to use a lot of color. The projections of climate change have only recently focused on marine capture. We've only recently talked about global food supply. There was no major chapter in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 2007 on fisheries. Climate change might lead to large-scale redistribution of global catch potential with a 30 to 70% increase and a drop of about 40%. This data is actually pretty well recognized. We have a lot of other data sets telling us exactly this. But what we know is in the case of Indonesia, it's one of the regions of the world in which we expect the largest drop in the context of large marine fish. Next slide. So what else do we see from this increased acidification? Reduced calcification, the binder of corals themselves. I see this a lot. I'm originally from the Caribbean. Throughout the region, we're seeing exactly this. Shift in phytoplankton, the plants themselves. Reduced tolerance to environmental fluctuations. Next. Changes to species survival. Changes to food webs, and reduced growth. These are the major issues that we're seeing as a result of the biological implications of ocean acidification. The uncertainties are great, but that does not mean we do not know anything. That, more than anything, is an honest statement about the future. We are tending towards a particular future, and the only thing that protects us is not precise action on our models, but providing the buffers in our systems, the marine protected areas, the shellfish protection, because that's an admission that we don't know the future exactly. Next slide. So you can skip this one. I went through some of this already. Where are most of the studies predicting large distributional shifts? Look at Southeast Asia. That's where we're seeing most of the distributional shifts in fisheries over time. That was the reason for showing this. These are global studies done around the world by numerous people. There are compared data. This is not just one study. Next. But a critical thing, of course, as everyone in this room knows, is that climate by itself is not what creates disasters. It creates the hazard, but it doesn't create a disaster. It's our actions and the things that we do that change a hazard into a disaster. When we try to integrate coastal development, marine pollution, overfishing, destructive fishing, and you look at the top right, there are conditions in 2011 going from blue of low threat down to dark red and critical, and down at the bottom is 2030. Given the trends as we see them now in coastal development, overfishing, watershed pollution, you can see to some extent the change from yellow regions to deeper red. When we look at the bottom left slide, that's an early warning system some of us played a role in helping to develop in 2010. It was one of the few years in which the entire globe saw events of coral bleaching. And we're anticipating that by 2050, conditions in the bottom left might occur every 3 to 5 years instead. Hopefully not, but that's the way it's trending. So system responses from global climate change will be superimposed on already existing anthropogenic threats. What does that mean is that even if the change is small, 1 to 2 degrees, which is the window in which corals live, or you don't need that much to push them over the edge. Next slide. I'm wrapping. I'm about almost there. I'm not, but it gives the moderator some confidence. Anyway, so the shifting baselines and thresholds are the key thing. The background is changing. It doesn't have to change much to change our extremes. The perception of what is considered normal shifts with each generation, and decade to decade, things shift. There's the Scientific American article, How Coral Bleaching Can Lead to Famine. A little bit overstated, but the issue is much more one of understanding the role that fish protein and fish nutrients play in small communities' diets. We're expecting more than 1 degree C higher than the summer maximum, and 1 degree C is what drives coral bleaching. Last slide. So where are we? To summarize, climate crosses many timescales. We're not just dealing with the change, anthropogenic change issue, but when you combine bleaching and a background change in climate, what we have is surprises in the system. Overfishing is the primary cause. New technologies and overcapacity can contribute to that. Climate change poses an emergent threat, but so does present climate. And the things we use to manage our interactions, which you'll hear more of from the next two speakers, are the things that actually drive our risks. That combined with shifting baselines and lack of fisheries data to support management is really creating this situation. Next. So to wrap up, we're asking more clearly how to connect food security dimensions in a changing climate. We know the changing ocean conditions and key biological interactions will occur under climate change. There are some examples up above. And from my standpoint, improving the use and usefulness of the climate information we use and develop in our financial services, risk pooling capabilities, and early warning systems are where NOAA and others try to come in to bring information to bear on this problem. The last slide. We're all in this together, but if you look down at the right, that's not necessarily how we act. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Roger. And for those, with Roger's permission, we will post those slides. And so for those of you who didn't get every single piece of data on the way, you will have a chance to come back to our website and review these slides, review this information. But thank you very much. I'd like to introduce Dr. Barbara Best. She's Senior Coastal Resource Management and Policy Specialist for USAID. She has over 25 years of experience in marine research and the design and evaluation of international development programs. She provides technical support to our USAID missions in strategic planning, activity design, program evaluation related to coastal resource governance, climate change adaptation, fisheries management, food security, and marine biodiversity conservation. So I think you'll agree that she's the right person for this discussion. Thank you, Barbara, for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I want to start by thanking CSIS for taking a leadership role in trying to highlight and profile this very important issue. This issue of fisheries and food security is all too often overlooked. Globally, the health of our oceans and our coastal communities are under threat, not only from climate change, as Roger illustrated in his excellent presentation, but also just from a lack of attention to ocean issues, from oftentimes poor governance and weak management capacity. The current direction of both fisheries and, I would say, aquaculture, that of farming fish, is really not on the path that we need for food security and also for adaptation to climate change impacts. We need a fundamental shift in the way that we view oceans and we use ocean resources. We need to move away from this open access regime of fisheries to one that promotes managed access and secure resource rights. We need to change the way we collect and manage fisheries. Oftentimes, the way that we catch fish now actually reduces the natural productivity of the environment. We need to realign the short-term economic benefits with long-term sustainable and resilient use objectives. And we need to maximize economic returns rather than trying to catch the maximum amount of fish. And we need to redirect aquaculture and fish farming towards more sustainable and responsible practices. So this fundamental shift can be achieved by several things. First, we really need to take a systems approach to food security, one that integrates not just across terrestrial lands, but also the seascapes and the marine realm. We have to look at securing resource rights to those resources, promote a nature-based approach to adaptation. We have to dispel some of the myths about the demise of wild fisheries, and we have to take a realistic look at the threats posed by unsound aquaculture. So improving the management and the governance of wild fisheries and coastal habitats is critical, not only to food security in this region, but also to their ability to adapt to climate change. We know from research that improving fisheries management on coral reefs can make them more resilient to increasing sea surface temperatures. They can withstand these coral bleaching events much better when they are better managed. And we know that about a billion people in Southeast Asia, that's a billion with a B, depend on coral reefs for food security. Many of the countries in Southeast Asia are very much aware of the importance of fisheries to food security, as well as nutrition, livelihoods, and their national economies. but they sometimes lack the governance frameworks, they lack the resources and the capacity to adequately implement sustainable management plans. It was in this recognition that six countries from the Coral Triangle region came together and established the Coral Triangle Initiative for coral reefs, fisheries, and climate change. The objective of the initiative is to safeguard the vast marine and coastal resources upon which millions of people depend for food security and livelihoods. Indonesia's president at the time was instrumental in leading this initiative, which also involves Malaysia, Papua New Guinea, the Philippines, Solomon Islands, and Timor-Leste. The U.S. government through USAID, the State Department, and NOAA were some of the earliest and strongest supporters of this initiative and continue to be so. Indonesia's marine resources are not just of regional importance. They're of global importance. Indonesia has the world's greatest repository of marine biological resources. It lies at the epicenter of the Coral Triangle. And though it just covers 3% of the globe, it contains more than half the world's reef and 3/4 of all known coral species. And it's this biological richness which forms the basis for Indonesia's valuable fisheries. Fisheries generate some 20% of the GDP and contribute over 60% to Indonesia's protein consumption. And we cannot ignore the contribution of fish to micronutrients. They play a vital role as well. Under the U.S.-Indonesia Comprehensive Partnership, marine resources management is a key element of USAID's environment and climatic activities. USAID support includes the 5-year, 35 million marine resources program, partnerships in ocean research and maritime law enforcement capacity building. The goals of our ocean partnership with Indonesia are to conserve and restore the marine biodiversity, the foundation of their wealth, promote sustainable and resilient fisheries management while improving their profitability, strengthen maritime enforcement and surveillance, reduce poverty and increase food security, increase resilience to climate change and natural disasters, and work together to better understand marine ecosystems. It's particularly our work with the Ministry of Marine Affairs and Fisheries, with private sector partners, NGOs, and fisheries scientists all help to contribute to sustainable increases in wild fisheries production. We're also focused on building the management and capacity that's needed for both management of the fisheries and adaptation to climate change. We're expanding marine protected areas, which help nurture and sort of conserve the valuable banks upon which future generations can draw. And we're also strengthening enforcement of regulations to prevent loss of this value from illegal fishing. I also wanted to add, the U.S. is one of the largest importers of fish, coral, and coral reef animals from Indonesia and the Coral Triangle region. So in addition to providing technical and diplomatic support, U.S. consumers, the private sector, and government can play a critical role by creating demand for sustainable products. We want to acknowledge the challenges that lay ahead in addressing the threats to Indonesia's marine resources. But we are confident that by working together with Indonesia and other countries and other partners in the region, we can find sustainable solutions to preserve these marine assets for future generations. And I hope today's discussion will help highlight some of the ways that government, the private sector, NGOs, and scientists can work together towards this vision of a blue economy that's achieved by addressing key threats while promoting sustainable and responsible management of marine resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barbara. I have visited many of the projects that Barbara's describing, very, very effective coastal management projects that USAID is engaged in. Barbara mentioned the comprehensive partnership in which these programs are embedded. I would also mention that part of that is a Millennium Challenge Corporation commitment of $600 million over the next 5 years, two-thirds of which is going towards environment, green prosperity, they call it, but environment-related projects. And we are only one of many of Indonesia's development partners. Let me introduce Blaine Olson, a partner in Anova Holding USA, a U.S. holding U.S.-based holding company, which owns Anova Food, the largest distributor of sushi-quality tuna from Indonesia. Blaine lives and works in Bali. He's a marine science graduate and 29-year veteran of the tuna industry, and throughout his career has focused on the growth of sustainable tuna fisheries in Indonesia through the Fishing and Living Program. He works very closely with local fishermen and processors, with NGOs such as WWF Indonesia, with the Ministry of Marine Affairs and Fisheries, USAID, and other organizations towards the goal of certifying sustainable handline tuna fisheries. Thank you, Blaine. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Well, thank you, Ted. And I just want to say both presentations were excellent. And as a commercial person and someone who actually travels throughout Southeast Asia buying seafood items, these two of the best presentations I've seen on actually what is happening. And I hope today I can put a little bit of a face on the situation in Indonesia so you can see how both what Dr. Bess and Dr. Pulwardi have said has a factor in the real world. So first of all, U.S. Anova Holding is a U.S.-owned company. And again, I'm based in Bali, Indonesia. If you eat a piece of tuna somewhere in the United States, if you go to accounts like Outback or P.F. Chang's or any of the big restaurant chains and many of the big supermarkets, the tuna has generally been produced by a company in Indonesia and imported by Anova Food into the United States. Next slide. Now, we started the Fishing and Living Program, and, of course, our big USAID.
Well done.
down on the We are a Anova actually created this 4 years ago. The function of the Fishing and Living Program is to promote sustainable small-scale fisheries through improved fisheries practices. Our ultimate goal is MSC certification, which is a stamp that says, yes, this fish really is sustainable. But also as part of that, we realized from the very beginning that we must work with the communities to enhance their livelihoods so that it's just not about telling them what to do about go catch a big fish or don't catch any fish. It's about improving the quality of life. The project has grown quite large over 4 years. It actually stands on its own now. And we do receive, first, a great collaboration with the IMX program with USAID, and we also receive funding from USAID for a lot of our staff. We have about 27 people engaged in the program now, and this year we'll go over the 40 mark. So it's a great project. It's a public-private partnership that works both with USAID, with the Indonesian government, and also a number of the institutions, universities, and so forth in Indonesia. And it is totally Indonesian-managed. We only have one Westerner that's on it. It's a completely Indonesian-managed project. Next one. Okay, let's talk about food security and how it relates to commercial fisheries. First of all, in Indonesia, as Roger brought up, there's in the whole world, that first number, you have 84% of the fisheries in the world are seriously overfished. They're overexploited, and many are at the point of collapse. Indonesia is no different. Indonesia actually is very is way up there on the list. So first, there's serious overfishing. Second, there's an expansionist policy. The Indonesian government is continually promoting the expansionism, even though that there's most of the data points that we should go back to 2010 levels. The third thing, which is really out of control, is rampant IUU fishing. And IUU fishing is illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. That means a boat from somewhere, some other country that doesn't have a license, comes into Indonesian waters and catches fish, and then runs out of Indonesian waters with the fish. Indonesia being such a large mass from one end to the other, and so many different islands and so forth, it's very difficult to manage that. What this has done over the last 5-6 years, I've been buying tuna in Indonesia since 1997. But in the last 5 to 6 years, we've seen a serious decline in tuna. We estimate we're at 20% of the 2006 levels. Coastal fishermen who we work with are now having to travel further to find fish. It's becoming much more difficult and much more expensive for them to catch fish. When they come back in, and a lot of times they're not catching any fish at all. So the problem when it comes to food security is this fisherman comes in, he has no fish to eat, and he also has no cash fish to sell to buy any other form of protein. Kind of back up a little bit about what's going on in Indonesia. This is a code of conduct of responsible fisheries. It was done by WWF. in 2011, and it shows the extent of, it was a comparison between Indonesia, Malaysia, and Philippines, the extent of the management of fisheries, the extent of the decline of fisheries, and the problems that actually exist, and why it's so important to address them. Two things that are very important is you see control of excess fishing capacity got a zero, and then extent and control of illegal fishing got a 1.2. These are the problems that Indonesia faces, where you have large-scale vessels coming in and taking all the fish away. Next slide. Now, to give a classic example, you see two different fishing styles here on the bottom. On the left is a typical handline fisherman in Indonesia that we support and work with, and all of the money that man, for that fish, goes to that man and to his fishing community. On the right, this is not an Indonesian picture, but this is a typical Persian vessel. It's a large industrial vessel that fish all over the world. So what we see in Indonesia is there are upwards of 250 of these large 300-ton vessels operating. They go and catch the fish. They bring it back to some port and transfer it to a Thai carrier vessel who then takes the fish back to Thailand for processing. It doesn't get processed in Indonesia. And the other major issue is that they're targeting the juvenile tuna. There's not so many of the big tuna left in Indonesia, so now they're going, and I can't remember the quote, but they're creating a disaster, even worse, by now targeting the juveniles instead of the adults. So again, all this tuna is processed in Thailand, and through an FDA loophole, it then becomes product of Thailand and then gets shipped to the U.S. market. And no one quite really understands that this is going on. Next one. So how do you prevent this? Well, there's actually a very good trend happening in the U.S. We're a few years behind the EU, but this is this slide comes from Greenpeace, and this was their 2012 seafood retailer scorecard. And you see Safeway at the top and a few at the bottom. But the most important thing about this slide is you see that down in the bottom in the center, the circle of 2008, all of the supermarkets failed for sustainability efforts. And now you see in 2012, Safeway, Whole Foods are green, but you also see 78% of the supermarkets surveyed actually pass on sustainability. So supermarkets in the U.S. market is now looking at sustainability and trying, in a sense, prevent these problems from happening. Next slide. So in my quick 5 minutes, it's very important that we as a market, the U.S., do not take all of the fish from Indonesia. Secondly, it's important that the supermarkets and the food service industry focuses on sustainability. The other problem in Indonesia, the last point, is that there's little or no alternative livelihood for a fisherman who lives in a small coastal community. There's nothing else for him to do but fish. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Blaine. I'm going to take the prerogative as moderator to ask the first question as you all think about the questions that you may wish to ask. And with this audience, I'm very confident that we'll get some good questions. The other day, the vice president said there's no silver bullet with regard to the gun control problem, resolving the gun control challenges. I think the same can be said here. There's no one solution to address a multifaceted, complex problem such as you've just seen described. But there are things that we can do. And I want to ask our panelists, Blaine started discussed the sustainability and sort of addressing the challenge at the demand end. I want to ask our panelists to help us think through what can we, the U.S. government, the U.S. private sector, do to contribute to addressing this problem, and also what can multilateral institutions such as APEC and ASEAN do to help deal with the problem a little more broadly. I'm going to throw that one out, and then I'm going to ask all of you to join in with your questions. Blaine, Barbara?
Sure, I'll jump in on this one. There are a couple things that can be done, particularly because of the linkages with the markets. A couple years ago, the U.S. passed legislation that now requires any wood product coming into the U.S. to show where it is sourced and to say that it was sourced legally. Having something like that applied to fisheries would be a huge advance. Ideally, we want to promote the certification schemes because that goes beyond legality to sustainability. That's where we want to go, but we may have to take short steps to get in there. I was really amazed to see that there's this big FDA loophole for tuna. Certainly we can start addressing some of those loopholes to really ensure that consumers know where food, their fish is coming from and that it was taken responsibly.
To that, the EU actually put in a regulation January 2 years ago where a catch certificate was required for all imports into the EU. And every country in the world panicked and didn't know what to do, but they all sorted it out in about 2 or 3 months. So that now that if you export tuna or shrimp or any product to the EU, there's a catch certificate. That doesn't exist in the U.S. So as far as government, that would be something that can easily be done. About 10 years ago, the U.S. government put in place what's called HACCP, which is basically a food safety program. And you have to pass the FDA HACCP standards now to send fish from a foreign country to the U.S. So it can be done. I mean, these traceability and sustainability issues, like with the wood, can actually be done by the government. And then again, as consumers, number one. But number two, the market needs to have some pressure put on it to actually continue to think about sustainability.
Thank you. Thanks for the great comments. The idea in an uncertain environment in terms of planning, you know, calls to mind the old planner's dictum that perfect planning is a figment in the mind of the planner. And from the standpoint of changes over time, as we talk about acidification and as we talk about the combination of climate extremes, climate variability, and change, when you add those things together, what you get is a surprise in the system. We can't actually know the future as precisely. We know some pieces of it. So as a result, the types of things that we're hearing are the things that provide buffers for our systems, getting a better sense of what constitutes both an upper and a lower limit for viable fisheries is critical, because there are many cases around the world in which the ocean conditions changed, the fishery production went down, but we increased efforts to catch those remaining fish and collapsed the system. From that standpoint, when we talk about communities and community management, one of the things we, and the people next to me, Ted and others, know this, and people in the room do, we do not fully assess the transactions costs of engaging local people. Engaging people in planning is a time-consuming thing for them. They have day-to-day things to do. If we want to be engaged in local monitoring, if we want to be engaged in enforcement and compliance, then we have to ask what, in fact, does it cost for a local community to do that and direct some of our planning and practice to sustaining and maintaining the transactions costs in fisheries co-management. Otherwise, it will constantly be a supply-demand relationship.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, please.
Well, thank you. I'm Andre Sobajo, and I'm the chief representative in Vietnam. I'm a chief representative in Vietnam for the Interstate Traveler Company. But I used to market in Indonesia, among other countries, for Northrop. And at that time, I think my question is directed to Mr. Olson. They were already, the countries were poaching Indonesian waters. You know, yellow-tailed tuna fish, everything. And so one of my marketing objectives was to try to market remotely piloted reconnaissance drones that could be fired from a Indonesian Navy ship. And you know, they were very interested in it, but, you know, I changed jobs before that ever came to pass. So my question is, are they taking security measures in this, you know, military-type security measures to try to catch these poachers and then, you know, do something about it? And the other question is, how about this situation in the South China Sea with the encroachment into the extended exclusive economic zones of Vietnam and the Philippines and Malaysia? And is that complicating the international effort?
Answer the first half of that. The U.S. government has, to my knowledge, has done quite a bit of work with the Indonesian government as far as surveillance and monitoring goes. I know there's a good 40, I believe, Coast Guard representatives in Indonesia that are working with the Indonesian government in training them how to spot illegal fishing vessels and so forth. The problem, again, is that it's such a vast area to cover that the fishing vessels over there, the Navy vessels over there, and by the time it gets there, it's gone. So there is a lot of collaboration on that between the U.S. government. And the second question, I'm not quite sure.
The,
You can do that, Ted.
In the Yiwu Archipelago.
I think I can, maybe I can help with that.
And also your statement about the old Chinese proverb that be careful or we'll get where we're going.
Yeah.
There's an even worse Chinese proverb from Chairman Mao, which is, it's always darkest just before it goes completely black.
A lot of times when people look at the South China Sea, they think about oil and gas. And those are resources that people are competing for. But I think it really is important to look at fish as a key element in that quest for resources. Certainly the Indonesian government considers it key. A lot of our collaboration with Indonesia, Blaine mentioned some of it, it has been to make sure that the Indonesians have information on which they can act. We provided a radar system along some key routes that the Indonesians have been able to use for military purposes, but also can use for civilian law enforcement purposes. Barbara brought up the crucial issue of governance, and one of the challenges the Indonesians face is that it's very hard for them, for the military, to share that information with civilian law enforcement. So the military is out looking for ships, but they're not necessarily looking for the kind of ships that civilian law enforcement entities would be looking for. But sharing that information is probably a crucial element. And let me just add one thing to something that Blaine said that may not have resonated with everyone in the room. He said that the fishermen are catching juvenile tunas. Tuna propagate at about age 11. Is it age 11?
Sorry, the yellowfin is 3 plus. The bluefin tuna is 11.
11. Bluefin tuna, 11. Yellowfin, 3 plus. So when they start catching the juvenile fish, that means that there will be no future. There will be no future tuna. And that's one of the things that I think has given people put up the red flag is that the fish that they're catching are smaller and smaller and smaller, so it means no future fish. Let's be clear, it's not just Chinese fishing boats or Taiwanese fishing boats. It's fishing boats from all over the region. So Vietnamese fishing boats as well that are going into Indonesian waters. So, please.
I'm David Jocelyn. I work with the Chicago Council. Global Affairs. I'd like a little broader perspective on the problem from the panelists. Could you describe the negative effects on ocean fisheries caused by terrestrial agriculture? And another issue I'd be interested in hearing your opinion on is we hear a lot from NGOs, conservation NGOs, that one way to most benefit ocean fisheries is to buy and eat farm-raised fish. I'd appreciate your view on that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I'll be glad to start with this at least. I'm glad you raised that issue about terrestrial impacts on ocean health. We're seeing more and more documentation of that, particularly as we do poor land use management, either the soil or over-fertilization of the fields or pesticides can get washed down into estuaries and into the ocean. Now, some people don't realize that the quality and the quantity of fresh water going into the oceans is vital for their health. And so by having too much of a good thing, even you might think fertilizer might be good, it can really degrade the coastal estuaries in particular. For those of you who live here, the Chesapeake Bay health is of great interest, and it's because of poor land use practices and excess nutrients going into the bay beyond its capacity to deal with it. And this can create what we call as dead zones. Literally, there's no oxygen in these areas, and that really diminishes the productivity and the usefulness, the value of these. So there is quite a direct impact between terrestrial agriculture that's not done properly and coastal health and fishery health. I think at the last point, I saw that there's like 1,000 of these called so-called dead zones, which have been identified around the world, mostly in developed countries, but it's becoming more and more apparent in those developing countries which are doing more intensive agriculture. Does anybody else want to add to that?
Yeah. So one of the things, and to build on Barbara's point about these so-called hypoxic zones, that is critical to note that it is, in fact, a major issue in small island environments as well. It's just not as well publicized. Throughout the Caribbean, we have issues like this. The other part of agricultural land management that affects nearshore fisheries has to do with land management practices that allow for greater soil erosion and the deposits of sediments onto nearshore reef environments. One of the things from a climate standpoint we're beginning to see more of is the total amount of rainfall in some of these areas might not change, but when you get it changes. And how that affects the nearshore environment is like this. And we see it in Chesapeake, in fact. When the systems change in a way, and these are the trends, in which single heavy rainfall events are what you're seeing, and then longer dry periods between those events occur, you're accumulating all of the pesticides, fertilizer, and so on. And instead, when you get a heavy rainfall event, you're seeing a pulse into the system. The statistics are, in fact, showing that we're seeing heavy rainfall events separated by longer dry periods. For certain parts of the world, for anybody that says, hey, look, are you telling me it'll be wet and dry at the same time? The answer is every desert is shaped by water. The idea is that when we accumulate these over long term and then you get a heavy pulse, you've actually now put more into the nearshore system. In a lot of island environments, that's exactly what we're seeing.
Thank you. I think we had a question on sustainable aquaculture.
Well, and just the other big connection between terrestrial agriculture and fisheries is the use of water. We know how important water is and to fish habitats, and the diversion of water can have tremendous impacts in reducing the quality and the quantity of fish. Can you hear me now? All right. 40% of all wild fish caught in the world are ground up and used as fish meal, primarily for aquaculture, but also for livestock. Now think about that. Fish are not feeding people. They're being fed to other fish and to livestock. And in some cases, the conversion ratios are just amazing. In some species of fish, it takes 3 to 10 pounds of wild fish to produce 1 pound of farmed fish. So not all farmed fish is going to be sustainable or contribute to food security. The other statistic to look at is if you look at the global production of aquaculture, only about 25% comes from what we call filter feeding animals. Those are on the lower trophic levels. These are the clams, the oysters, the cockles, people like to eat. These are actually very good to raise because you don't have to use any inputs. They filter particles out of the water. That's why they're called filter feeders. So you don't have to add any grains or any additional food to raise those fish. So you get a real net benefit to food security. But only 25% of all the farmed fish are coming from those lower trophic levels. So there are ways to use aquaculture to help benefit food security while reducing the impacts to the environment. With those higher trophic level fish, particularly salmon and groupers, you have to add a lot of food for them to feed on, and not all of that is utilized by the fish, and it can actually help pollute the nearby environment. So that's another big impact it's having on and degrading the environments where farm-raised fish is occurring. Some people are promoting that we should really be using land-based fish tanks in order to raise the fish. That way you can have the most efficient systems. You can actually recirculate the pollutants, capture them, use them to fertilize the fields. And you can actually grow multi-species in one little tank. And so you can have sort of a simple food chain going on in the tank as well.
Thank you. Other questions? Sir.
I'm Gafur. I'm Indonesian Consul General in New York. I follow thoroughly what's been mentioned by Dr. Pulwarti. I was the Director for Economic Development and Environmental Affairs in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs before I sent in New York. So the story that you put forward about the climate change and how hard when we have to deal with other nations, how to put into the perspective of the climate change negotiation, the issue of the difficulty that we as a nation of consists of 17,000 islands that we face not only for the adaptation, and then later on we also cooperated well with the USAID as NOAA and other countries for the coral reef coral triangle initiative, sorry. And again, that is the old story for me, but since that I'm here in New York, I again has got the privilege to hear the presentation of Mr. Olson. This is what we've been facing in the US. In one sense, yes, we have to protect our environment and we have to take care of the coral reef in order to survive. In order to breed the fish that be consumed by not only for our country but for the whole world, in the case that we export most of our products to the U.S. and to the European Union, but here last month or in the last few weeks, we just got the issue that brought by some colleagues from the business side in the U.S. And I believe this might be not the proper venue to discuss that. But I would like to draw your attention, most of the participants here, because most of the speakers, they know already about Indonesia and especially Mr. Olson dealing with our fishermen. Yes, our country is a new country in terms that we declare our independence not only not more than 70 years ago, and we face difficulty in terms of in many fields, and we are in the early stage of development. What I would like to convey is that, yes, if we are talking about food security and fish production, yes, you have to deal with the fishermen itself. The fishermen's 3.5 million, they are not as big as Miss might be in the way that they are not big fishermen that have a big ships. No, they are small fishermen with a small boat, as pointed by Mr. Olson. And again, here, when the government tried to introduce the 2011-2025 master plan for shrimp, for instance, and here is how to bring and then provide some financial a package and also technology for the fishermen. And then we face here in the U.S. that, and they mention this kind of subsidies. And it is, in the one way, maybe some people get benefit of the fish that been that always there in the area of the archipelago, and also being could consume the production. But if we are talking about the fishermen, it is a different story. So I just want to convey that in terms of the bilateral relation of fishing, fishing sector between the two countries.
Terima kasih. Thank you. And I think very much appreciate your comments. We approach this in the spirit of partnership. That what can we do to be helpful? How can scientific developments that have been achieved in this country be made available so that they're useful to everybody, most particularly those who are the stewards of the world's most valuable resources. Thank you. Other questions? Please. Right here.
I'm Marlene Mockhut. I'm with Mars Corporation. And we have been doing a lot of work in sustainability in our cocoa side of our business. And it's in a way, it's very similar in terms of the many, many farmers, small farmers that are working on cocoa. But we also have a major cocoa center in Indonesia. And we have a few projects going on there. And I wanted to ask Dr. Pulwarti if a small program that we've got going to try and restore some of the coral reef. Is that a futile project because it's going to be destroyed again anyway with the warming? Or is, you know, making us feel better for that we're doing something? Or is that actually a beneficial project?
It's an excellent question, because what that question brings out is the fundamental question about planning for the future. Are things that we have done in the past viable for the future? Because that tells us whether or not the way we've adapted over time is, in fact, something that can be put into place now. Does that work? From the standpoint of certainly revegetation and the reintroduction of corals, the thresholds are pretty clear. What ends up happening is, while you have a temperature threshold, the management of human impact on the coral becomes the thing that determines the impacts. Now, from that standpoint, the Red Cross, as you might know, in Vietnam, is actually paying folks to replant mangroves, things like that. The reason why I'm mentioning this is that I really think that programs like that are highly laudable, because what they do is it reintroduces the type of protection that cannot be substituted economically. By a bar does not create the same benefit. But at the same time, the reason I brought up the transaction cost of co-management is that unless you have folks working on reducing the human impact on that area, that then pushes it into the area of futile practice. But the temperature itself and the impacts of temperature can actually be managed if we reduce several of these other risks. Now, the only way we've been able to do that is, of course, by showing people the benefit of engaging in that effort. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And there's an economic benefit. I just will point out that one of the projects that Mars has in Sulawesi is to grow seahorses. Oh. And I don't know if they're filter feeders or not, but they're highly profitable. And instead of fishermen going out and blowing up coral to get these very, very valuable seahorses, they're being grown in villages. It's a small enterprise, but being sold they're exported at a very high sort of per seahorse cost, and they're providing good sustainable livelihoods for a lot of fishermen. So
this is an
example of the private sector doing something really, really useful. Yeah.
What I'd like to add to what Ted is reminding us of is this. Whenever we say, look, yeah, sure, maintaining coral reefs, that'll protect the national interest, you reduce the impacts of storms, you reduce the national risk on insurance, unless there is also this very local, direct alternative, as Blaine pointed out, and as I think, Barbara, you mentioned as well, our major issue on pressure has to do with the lack of alternatives in terms of viable local economies. That's the major pressure. So whenever we argue at the national level and working with the development banks, hoi, this is going to reduce our disaster impact, that's relevant, but the idea of the local economy is as relevant.
Yes. Can I just add a few things to that? This whole concept of creating alternative livelihoods is an ideal situation. But so many times people have created livelihoods, but it has had no effect on the fisheries, which is the main economy in these communities. So without addressing the governance issue, who can actually fish, everybody loses in the end. You might create a few jobs. So if we can turn around fisheries and make them profitable, even for a fewer number of people, they will start creating jobs in their own villages. Once people have disposable income, they will then pay to go out to a restaurant to eat. Otherwise, these people, they never go out. They cook and they prepare their own meals. they repair everything that they own. So once we can get fisheries to be more profitable, then you have an economic engine that, which will help create alternative livelihoods. One of the things that we're trying, not in Indonesia but elsewhere, is working with communities, having them decide how many people should be in a fishery so that they have a community ownership of the process. And then once they agree to certain conditions, then we'll start creating alternative livelihoods for those who want to drop out, so you reduce the number of people actually fishing, and others cannot join that. So that's one way to start creating wealth and profitability in the fisheries.
Please. Thank you. I follow your trend of thought. My name is Jin Ying Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. And so we're talking about Indonesia, but has there been a concern, an effort at the regional governance, like ASEAN? Are you thinking of bringing it to ASEAN to create a governing system so that everybody can protect the livelihood of fishermen in that coastal areas? Because I know that Vietnamese, many of us, a majority of us live off the coast, and many of us are earning livings by fishing. And the livelihood now is in danger because of all the conflicts. And many fishermen actually have been killed or harassed when they went out fishing in their own water. So there's a concern of governance system. And the second question has to do with the human impacts. As oil companies coming in and all of that effect of oil in the sea, how do you see, how do you foresee, or has there been any other best practices elsewhere in areas where oil industry have made their, starting their company there? So is there anything that we can ask the oil companies when they come into the Pacific Ocean, and especially in the Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, for example, is there anything that we can ask them to cooperate with us with their revenue to put in to help with the fisheries, educations, and governance?
I'd be delighted to answer the first question. It's actually in the last year and a half, Vietnam, on the commercial side and the government side, has very much woken up to fisheries management and sustainability. Typically, pangasius, the Vietnamese catfish, and shrimp have been the major exports for Vietnam. But in the last year and a half, tuna's become much more important, and it's a pelagic export. And both the NGO community, really headed by WWF and their Coral Triangle Initiative program, has brought Vietnam in. And both VASEP, which is the Exporters Association, and the Fisheries Ministry have just jumped on the subject. So we're impressed. I mean, it's actually catching up with Indonesia very quickly. As far as the oil companies go,
Chevron is one of those companies, and Chevron has done a great deal in terms of capacity building in Indonesia. They fund schools. Actually, I don't know if they do anything specifically on fisheries, but I think some our resource companies are learning more and more that it can't be just about extraction. It has to be about kemitraan. It has to be about partnership. So it has to be about capacity building. It has to be about developing expertise, developing scientific knowledge, understanding of these resources, not just about extraction. I think the more companies that learn that lesson, the better off they will do in a country like Indonesia. Barbara?
Yeah, if I can just add a few more comments about working with oil companies. One thing that many countries, the developed countries, use, but other countries may not use, is something called an environmental performance bond. So when a company, extractive company, wants to start extracting in the host country government, they have to establish and set aside funds into a bond which will cover if there's any mishap. So they have more of a skin in the game. This has to be a pretty high environmental bond, and so that will help cover any sort of mishaps that may happen. The other thing that we're seeing, particularly if it's offshore extraction, is that oil companies want to reduce any potential conflicts. Now, fishing boats, and particularly dredging, can be a risk to the oil companies, particularly where they're transferring the oils. So we have worked in Ghana, off the coast of Ghana, with oil companies and the fishermen, fisher people, women included, to set up what we're calling sort of no fishing areas, which are sensitive to the oil companies. And so this actually helps enhance the fisheries productivity. The fishermen are benefiting, as well as helping to reduce the risks to the oil companies. And so having those negotiations early on could be a benefit to both.
My name is Leanne Sadowski, and I work with Nathan Associates, which is currently implementing the USAID project, the ASEAN-US Market Program, which deals with regional food security. And I was just wondering, given my take on the role of ASEAN in the region, what specific topics that you feel that ASEAN itself could deal with at the regional level that would be better dealt with at that level rather than at the national level?
ASEAN and APEC, we should address for both of those institutions. But Blaine?
Simply illegal fishing, flags of convenience. If the ASEAN nations could get together and set quotas and actually allow other, there's nothing wrong with sharing a resource. The problem that exists in the ASEAN countries is the Vietnamese boats are running over to Indonesia. The Indonesian boats are running over to the Philippines. The Chinese boats are running everywhere. Taiwanese boats are running everywhere. If ASEAN could get could get together and set quotas and catch statistics for each area within the Coral Triangle, you would see a tremendous amount of you can increase your harvest, and you would see an economic benefit to each of the different countries. If you go just east of Indonesia, you have the PNA states, which are Micronesia, the Solomon Islands, Marshall Islands. They've gotten together and set their own quotas and issue licenses to vessels from all over the world to come in. And they're the height of fisheries management now. And as you know, that Papua New Guinea is part of that, borders right on Indonesia and borders right on the ASEAN states. So I think that's the number one thing, would be cooperation on fishing licenses and illegal fishing.
And I think we should add APEC. I don't know, Emily, if you want to answer anything, but Emily Tibbett from Nature Conservancy. The blue economy was Indonesia's original theme for its year in hosting APEC.
Yeah, hi, Emily Tibbett, Nature Conservancy. I just wanted to revisit the APEC-ASEAN theme here, and also to, because I think there is a lot of opportunity to take these great examples with ANOVA and MARS, and we're doing something with PT Bali Seafood on sustainability, to take these and leverage these across the region. President Yudhoyono has articulated a commitment to the importance of protecting these resources for sustainability and trade. APEC is all about trade liberalization and economic development. So, you know, it'd be interesting to look at APEC, which is being hosted by Indonesia this year. It's an important APEC because it's SBY's last major forum in terms of commitments. To look at the corporations, some of you, key corporations here and others, with governments essentially agreeing to sustainability targets and getting some of that into the language of these leaders, some of these declarations. There's also, of course, in this part of the world, probably more so than others, protecting the sort of the source geographies for the trade is absolutely critical. You can't have a robust trade unless you have a healthy environment. So there's a lot of opportunity, it seems, to advance some of these this thinking in that context, and ASEAN as well. And I think that I'd be curious on the panel's response to these ideas. It's something that we're working on. The Conservancy has a major sort of focus on APEC, particularly around this issue, as well as a couple of others. But be very interested in thoughts on that.
Just a quick comment, having interacted with the certainly the climate pieces with APEC through the APCC in Busan, the climate center. One of the things we do have to remember as we talk about these efforts, and as you raise this particular question, is it's certainly good to come in with the allowable catch, but for already vulnerable and almost collapsed fisheries, from a climate standpoint, the next 10 years is going to be really critical because we're seeing some move towards, you know, years in which you're really seeing these pulses of coral bleaching and so on. So for already vulnerable and collapsed species, the idea of the tension between allowable catch and those in the context of a rapidly transitioning ocean area, I think needs to be brought front and center. Otherwise, we'll come back to, you know, yeah, let's talk about governance. And we always talk, we've been talking about governance for 40 years. And so the question is, what and how do we sustain the type of interactions we heard from Blaine and others on the near term that provides alternatives to the local economy? From that standpoint, I think you get, at a regional level, a better discussion of the trade-off between total allowable catch and the already vulnerable and collapsed species. Because the near, as we're looking at these results, the next 5 to 20 years is going to be critical in terms of spikes in the system from the standpoint of ocean bleaching and so on.
APEC already has a kind of a structure that leads to its summit meetings in which fisheries is one of the subjects in which nations get together. I actually don't know whether ASEAN has such a structure. It certainly has a growing, strengthening secretariat in Jakarta, and this would be a very, very relevant issue for discussion within ASEAN.
My name is Sopat Sung from the Cambodian Institute for Cooperation and Peace. It's a Cambodian-based think tank. It's a different area, but of similar questions. So Cambodia is a country that relies, 80% of the animal protein comes from fish, more even than Indonesia, but it's mostly freshwater fish.
Tonle Sap.
Yeah, from the Tonle Sap Lake. And similarly, it's very threatened by hydropower plans as well as climate change. But what I'm trying to ask here is, judging from your discussion, is the Indonesian conservation initiative is a success, from my understanding or from what I hear here. So my question is how. But it seems to me part of it is that the fish is commercialized, and there is a partnership between the business community in terms of helping to have that the conversation. So my question is, what can be learned from the Indonesian model of conservation in terms of the governance, in terms of the management? I think maybe that question may be best to Dr. Best and Mr. Olson also, and that can be replicated elsewhere in mainland, for example, in mainland Southeast Asia, where I don't think that type of model exists yet. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. Let me just say that, you know, the partnership with Indonesia is ongoing. It's a very large country, and it's a very large challenge. We have some little successes. We really need to scale it up, and that's what we're hoping to do in partnership. But I think we have learned a few lessons, particularly when you have high-value trade commodities, such as Blaine talked about with the tuna. You really have a way to hook, so to speak, the communities and to really look at the whole value chain from the real drivers, the export market, all the way down to the management. And I think one of the key lessons is making sure that everyone along that value chain understands, works together, and begins to understand the importance of sustainability for everyone's livelihoods along that value chain. Certainly when you have a major company making a strong commitment to that, they understand this is an appropriate business model for them. They're trying to reduce their risks. Everyone along the value chain should have that same understanding as well. And that can really enhance the cooperation. When you don't have a strong export hook model, so to speak, where you have fish that are sold at local markets, that same sort of thing can work. We have examples elsewhere where, once again, the more you get people to come together to work collaboratively and to understand that they need to work in cooperation to once again try to ensure that there are the sustainable streams of fish coming in. We have a program that is operating in Tonle Sap. It is a huge challenge. You can work with the local communities, but in that case, with the hydropower, you need to be connecting communities all along the Mekong. You need to be connecting the countries along the Mekong. And so people understand that if someone benefits upstream, it doesn't come at the expense of people downstream. So, yeah, there are major challenges there because of the connectivity along the river and this big push for hydropower. I don't know if you have any other...
Yeah, let me expand on a little bit. I think the most valuable lesson we have, well, first of all, we're not successful yet. I mean, we're the USAID project is it's a 5-year project, and it's really the first year. We have worked for 4 years on sustainability, but we're getting very good models on how to work with the communities and, as Barbara said, to produce a very high-value fish. Rather than catch a juvenile that's worth, say, 20 or 30 cents a pound that goes into a can, you let that fish grow. You make it sustainable by letting it grow, and then you catch it, and it gets served in a sushi bar. So you can see the difference in value between two little pieces of sashimi and a canned tuna. So that's one thing. And the second thing also is to work very strongly on quality control and quality enhancement of the fish and throughout the supply chain so that you're teaching these people to handle the fish with ice, to kill it properly, to harvest it properly, and then deliver it to a processing plant that completely adds value to it. So that's the third point. Every piece of fish that we receive from Indonesia is at its highest market value when it leaves Indonesia. We don't ship a whole fish. We ship a chef-ready sushi block that goes into a sushi bar, and all he has to do is tear it open and slice. So those are the three main lessons that I think Cambodia could use. And I know there's processing plants. The processing eye is turned towards Cambodia with China becoming so expensive. So there are plants now in Cambodia that are starting to process. So anything you can get with the U.S. government, any cooperation with the U.S. government now is a really good time.
Just a quick comment. Given the two rich answers we just heard, Indonesia being a collection of islands, I'm originally from the Caribbean, where you have a collection of islands, but they also have their own economic zones. I live in Boulder, Colorado. That's another island. The idea here, however, is a fundamental question that you're asking, which is how does learning actually take place, even if we identify the lessons? And so from that standpoint, you know, we could, as said before, there are a lot of lessons identified, not necessarily learned. And so the comments you've heard from Barbara, from Blaine, from folks from Mars and elsewhere, a fundamental sort of question we have to ask is how is learning taking place among the other islands within Indonesia as well, in addition to countries within the region? And then what does it take to successfully assess, communicate, implement, and evaluate those in other places? Mm-hmm. Or do you leave it up to the market to pick up the things that are working or not? In which case, you might get some benefit, but it might not be for all the things that you're after.
And another institution in which we can share lessons learned is the Lower Mekong Initiative, the countries of the Lower Mekong Initiative. I think we have time for one more question. Is anybody out there ready? Otherwise, let me say thank you to all of the members of our panel, and thank you to you for joining in this discussion. Thanks very much.